CKUW, where people share the music they love. 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. Find our program schedule in every issue of Stylus Magazine.
Welcome to the Meta World Stupaloop Show. I am your host, IMA Karen Elliott. Today on the Meta World Stupaloop Show, as part of our yet another UFO series, we go off planet and back with a look at the Men in Black. Not the garbage series of Hollywood movies, the gray-skinned, Grand Victoria or LTD driving, outdated suit-wearing harassers of those who have allegedly come in contact with the flying saucers. No, the Nazis were not snappy dressers, these people are. It falls somewhere between Joseph Beuys and Dick Tracy, fits the boxy sedans to a T-good hats. Diner hats, if you will. If you should accidentally see the wrong kind of lights, they'll come a knockin' all slightly off kilter and strange and tell you that you saw swamp gas, a weather balloon, or perhaps nothing at all. As urban myths and true stories go, the Men in Black encompass everything a good one needs. It's murky and weird and speaks to a historically fairly well-founded mistrust of government. It culminates in an October 14, 2008 sighting in Niagara Falls, New York, caught on a hotel security camera. They were looking for hotel manager Shane Sovar, who had reported having seen a UFO several weeks earlier. Like everything in this cultural territory, the fact that not a lot is known about them is proof of their existence, as is any sort of official insistence that we have no proof of their existence. and we get into a loop that goes on forever. On the Meta World Stupaloop Show on CKUW 95.9 FM, I am your host, I am A. Karen Elliott, and this week on the Meta World Stupaloop Show, the Men in Black.
talk to two kinds of people, those who claim to have seen a UFO and those who research UFOs.
Has a black hat and at times black sunglasses. They present an appearance often described as strange or odd. They speak in a dull monotone voice as if they were a computer. As mentioned before, they have pale to olive skin, but no matter what the color of the skin, it seems like rubber and in many ways fake compared to the skin of an ordinary human, and they also have high cheekbones. It's almost as if they've overdosed on Botox. They have thin, red, bright lips, pointed chins, and eyes that are mildly slanted. The Men in Black themselves are often on absurd goofball missions and don't ever seem to fit the part. They have reportedly posed as salesmen, telephone repairmen, or representatives from official or unofficial organizations. Their mode of transportation is often a large and expensive American-made car, Buick or Lincoln, sometimes a Cadillac, and of course, all MIB autos are colored in black. Beginning after World War II, the sighting of Men in Black really began to be seen by witnesses as UFO sightings began to skyrocket. In 1956, a book published by Ray Barker called They Knew Too Much About Flying Saucers is the first publication to coin the term Men in Black and tells the tale of one Albert K. Bender. Men in Black encounters are generally said to have begun in 1956
for transportation
with a case of a
license
UFO
plate numbers that don't
Albert
return
K.
any
Bender.
Information from
Bender
the Department of Motor Vehicles. Blacked out Mercedes-like automobiles that don't actually exist at all. Their sole purpose in visiting you is to inform you of how you didn't see a UFO, or that researching said subject is a waste of your time or a bad idea. One may find across many cases involving don't actually exist at all. Their sole purpose in visiting you is to inform you of how you didn't see a UFO, or that researching said subject is a waste of your time or a bad idea. This is the standard description one may find across many cases involving the Men in Black. However, not too far under the surface of the prototypical MIB synopsis lies a much more bizarre collection of stories, far more mysterious and far more dark. While some MIB may indeed be the secret eyes and ears of government departments, others appear to emanate from a much different origin. Let's start from the beginning, or to be more specific, what may have been the beginning. As
large, unhuman eyes, bizarre movements, and monotone robotic voices tell you that what you thought was an alien craft or alien being was just your imagination running wild. It wasn't really there, so do not go spreading it around to your friends or family, or we will bring you nothing but harm. They are said to work with or for the government and apparently often claim to be representatives of the nation of the Third Eye, or we will bring you nothing but harm. They are said to work with or for the government and apparently often claim to be representatives of the nation of the Third Eye, either as government officials or some part of the military service. Their appearance is believed to be somewhat agent-looking, with their black suits, hats, and sometimes glasses. Those who believe they have been contacted by them say that it's not their clothing that disturbs them, though, but their unusual facial features and odd behavior.
Black working for him that could have very well been from another world. Footage was discovered of his security at the U.S.-Israel policy conference, and they were looking rather alien-like. From the front, completely normal. From the back, we see a bald man with no ears and a pointy chin. His nose looks short and rounded, and his eyes appear to be dark and sunken in. Do you think there were possibly alien men in black guards guarding the president that day? It's definitely possible. In our number 7 spot, we have the Firewatch sighting. A man named Gabe was working a shift at a Firewatch tower in the woods when he saw a black SUV pull up in the wee hours of the morning. A few minutes later, the sound of a firearm went off. The next thing he knew, there was a knock on his tower and two large men in black were waiting behind the door. He opened the door and they immediately questioned him, asking him to reveal what he saw. He said he saw nothing, and after a moment, they appeared to believe him. They told him to never speak of this experience to anyone. Looking back, he definitely thinks he met one of the men in black. Originally, he chalked these men up to some kind of gang, but now he definitely thinks that those two men were the men in black. In our number 6 spot, we have the UFO researcher. In 1976, Dr. Herbert Hopkins, who is a UFO researcher, got a call from someone who claimed to be a rep from a New Jersey UFO organization. The man asked if Hopkins was alone and if Hopkins would be willing to share his research. Hopkins said, sure, and began sharing with him. Once he hung up the phone, a man was at his doorstep. He described the man as being bald, without eyebrows, wearing a neatly tailored black suit. He had red lips and pale white skin. The man took out a coin and told Hopkins to watch it. It started to develop a silver color instead of copper, and then the silver became bluish and the penny was getting, you know, out of focus, blurred, and then it was simply gone. Apparently, after this incident, he was instructed to destroy all of his research.
In our number 5 spot, we have the Dan Aykroyd story. This story is wild to me because I have literally had the thought, why doesn't the dad from Crossroads barely work anymore? Did Hollywood cast him out? Like, I literally just thought about this last week. Well, that honestly might be the case, and I certainly wonder about that after hearing about how he shared this story with people online. So 20 years ago, in 2002, 20 years ago, wow.
Bizarre movements and monotone robotic voices. This has led many to believe that the men in black might not actually be men in black, but instead extraterrestrial beings working alongside the government, trying to keep secrets from getting out. If you have seen the video I made about believed men in black encounters, you will know that visits from them date back to the Maury Island incident in 1947, but since then there have been hundreds of believed visits from them, five of which I talked about in that other video, such as Albert K. Bender's encounter in which men dressed in black harassed and threatened him after he was going to publish what he believed was strong evidence of alien sources, leading to him closing down his publications, right up to the famous actor Dan Aykroyd's encounter in New York City. But there are many more believed encounters, and an extremely interesting one is that of Danny Gordon. It all started in Wytheville, Virginia, on the morning of October the 7th, 1987, when radio reporter Danny Gordon checked in, but this time he reported over the radio that three local sheriff's deputies all claimed to have seen a UFO nearby. After Danny's skeptical report to the listeners, the radio station was flooded with people claiming that they too also witnessed the unknown craft. Being a skeptic and thinking it was just experimental aircrafts, 2 weeks after all the phone-ins and reports, Danny and his friend decided to take a trip to where these UFOs were being reported. They did see something strange in the sky, but it was the second day when they returned where Danny managed to get a photograph that would back up everyone's reports. He returned home, but before he had a chance to develop the photo, he said he received a call from somebody who refused to identify himself. He told Danny that the CIA and the federal government were very interested in the Wythe County UFOs. Danny also received a few unknown calls from a person saying, "It's not for your place to be messing in defense matters." Danny attended a press conference on the sightings on October the 23rd, 1987. And when he returned, he noticed his house had been broken into. Nothing was stolen, but Danny is convinced someone was looking for the photographs he took. He quickly developed them, but they were poor quality. But a few weeks later, he managed to spot the UFO again in the sky, outside of a mall whilst with his family, and once again photographed these mysterious lights. For weeks after this, he was harassed by phone calls from believed government agents. And on one occasion, two men visited his home to supposedly interview him about the UFO sighting. Danny said they stayed for around 45 minutes. One was talking and the other man was taking photographs of his home. They told him it would be published in the local newspaper and that they would send it to him.
Attitudes towards UFOs. They gave the following statement to a cross-section of the American public. Back in 1968, when the Condon Committee was sampling public attitudes towards UFOs, they gave the following statement to a cross-section of the American public. A government agency maintains a top-secret file on UFO reports, which are deliberately withheld from the public. The respondents were then asked to answer true or false. A substantial majority, almost two-thirds of all people surveyed, agreed with this assertion. Amongst teenagers, the gap was even wider, with almost 75% of them believing the statement to be true. If that same survey was carried out today, it is believed that the percentage of those in agreement would be even higher. This is hardly surprising, considering that we now live in an age of free-flowing information, or misinformation, depending on who you ask. And especially since the advent of the internet, it has become almost a normality to question and make accusations against those in power. But little over half a century ago, this lack of trust in government was nowhere near as prevalent as it is today. And one could argue that it all started back in the late 1940s, in the wake of what is now known as the Roswell incident. That one event, whether or not there is any truth to it, brought into the mainstream the very notion of government conspiracies and cover-ups. Throughout the 1950s, when the concept of flying saucers and visitors from outer space was still in its infancy, UFO witnesses and investigators alike were apparently being harassed, threatened, and ordered into maintaining silence by mysterious individuals known as the Men in Black. These strange men were often described as wearing black suits with dark hats, and that they travelled around in black cars, usually of the classic American variety.
Is then accosted by usually two individuals, often in pairs, sometimes singular, sometimes even more than two, but often two. And there are times when very like ordinary, like human-looking intelligence types approach someone and either warn them off of their investigations or will actually make it very clear to them that they're dealing with a UFO phenomenon. But in all cases, the idea is to scare off or intimidate the witness so that they don't pursue whatever it is that they're looking into.
Yeah, it all seems pretty horrible, especially if they threaten you or threaten your family, and you're not sure if they're from another planet or not.
Historical accounts of the Men in Black recall the overwhelming sensation of fear experienced by those who have had prior encounters with UFOs or something out of the extraordinary. This fear is a tool used to suppress an incredible UFO event from the public. What are their true goals? Are they outdated military relics from the past, or are they covertly influencing today's society through misinformation, fake news? The earliest recorded encounter with a man in black was in 1947. Harold Dahl, a conservationist, was near the shore of Murray Island in Washington.
Dahl's job was to retrieve serviceable lumber. that was often just floating around in the water back in those days. And he would bring it back, and that would be their business. That's their business. And so Dahl is out in a boat for this purpose with his teenage son and dog, actually. And he sees 6 discs.
Some other strange incident related to UFOs. The common denominator is that they invariably appear in an effort to obtain information from the witness or somebody who saw the event, the UFO or alien contact, or took pictures of something flying around in the sky. The MIBs utilize every technique possible to obtain the evidence of a UFO incident or event, including photographs.
With all of the media attention he had been getting during this time. But when he didn't receive the paper weeks after, he rang up the local newspaper and they told him that they had not run a report on him.
A few weeks later, Danny was looking through his UFO files, including some of the photographs he had taken, but noticed that the set he took outside of the Mall were missing. Danny was now confident the men who entered his home were the real Men in Black and had stolen the photographs. A few months later, Danny collapsed due to severe exhaustion and was cautioned that continuing his UFO research could jeopardize his health. So he broke contact with all things UFOs and has not had any more trouble. Since more than 1,500 people reported seeing UFOs in the sky within a 3-month period in Withville, it definitely makes this an interesting case. So maybe Danny was really telling the truth. He never really profited from telling his story, and with his health deteriorating, it seems only bad things came from it. So do you think he was tormented by the Men in Black, who were desperate to keep the photos he took from getting out into the public? Whether Danny's case is real or not, one thing all encounters have in common is the fact that these strange men seem to have a scary amount of knowledge on the person they are talking to. They seem to know dates, times, locations, and descriptions of exactly what the person has witnessed. And this next case is no different, and is probably one of the most interesting cases I have read about. It took place in the 1960s when Timothy Green Beckley, a UFO researcher, claims to have caught a real Man in Black on camera.
Present themselves as part of a secret organization, sometimes even producing a white card with a crest and the word security on it. And in some cases, they refer to each other by number rather than name. They threaten and scare people into remaining silent about their UFO encounters and/or research. Think of them as the cleaners of the extraterrestrial universe.
How much black do they actually wear? Do they look like the Men in Black that we see in the movies?
We'll get into what they really look like later.
Once they pull apart their skin and the alien comes out.
Now that you know the basics, here are, in my opinion, the most terrifying reports of encounters with the Men in Black. The first ever recorded experience with the Men in Black came from Harold Dahl in June 1947. Harold Dahl was out on his boat in the Puget Sound where he claimed he saw six giant donut-shaped objects in the sky. One of the objects fell apart, spilling debris that killed his dog and injured his son. He took photos of a lump of metal that he believed was from the UFO. A week later, Richardson said he was visited by two men in black suits.
Everybody out, and they were asking questions about you. There's a couple really strange-looking men that were here, and they kind of freaked everybody out, and they were asking questions about you. And, of course, now I'm getting a little bit nervous, and I'm like, what are you talking about? And he said, well, they were, he goes, I don't know how to describe them except for extremely odd-looking. They were the exact same height, they were wearing the exact same clothes, and they had the exact same faces, like they were twins. And he said they were wearing black suits, black trench coats. They were wearing like the old-fashioned Federal hats. They had extremely, extremely pale skin. And he said they came in and they asked for you. And I said, I'm sorry, he's actually not working today. And it seemed like they didn't believe me, so they started to walk around the hotel, and shortly after they went to the tour desk. But he goes, they freaked me out, and I really wanted to tell you that there were these weird guys in here looking for you. So of course now I'm a little bit skeptical and I'm a little bit freaked out all at the same time. So the first thing I do is I run into my security office and I rewound the cameras.
Expect some surprises along the way. From my own perspective, I always marked the start of the MIB visitation phenomenon as being in late 1947, post-Roswell. Reports of these dark visitors would carry on prominently through the 1950s and 60s. Interestingly, some two-fifths of all MIB cases originate between the years 1966 and 1968. Many of the sources that I checked to trace the MIB back as far as I could put the beginning of their intrusions in 1945, specifically a case involving a gentleman by the name of Albert Bender. Mr. Bender, a resident of Bridgeport, Connecticut, had an obsession with phenomena of the unearthly kind, an interest that predated not only the Roswell incident, but also Kenneth Arnold's encounter above Mount Rainier. As exciting as Bender's journey into the heart of the mysterious began, it ultimately became one of terror, poor health, and paranoia. The specific case that sparked the flame of Bender's obsession with high strangeness occurred on December 5th, 1945, when a squadron of Avenger-class aircraft vanished under mysterious circumstances after taking off from the Naval Air Station at Fort Lauderdale, Florida. The vanishing of this Flight 19, along with the Mariner flying boat that went searching for those aircraft and their 9 crew members, remains unexplained to this day, making it a legendary piece of the puzzle that is the famous Bermuda Triangle. 23-year-old Albert Bender was enthralled by the incident, thus becoming the starting point of his obsession. In April of 1952, Bender would establish a worldwide network of UFO investigators known as the International Flying Saucer Bureau, or IFSB, which would then lead Bender to publish his own magazine entitled Space Review. As time went on, Mr. Bender would establish himself as a well-known figure among other UFO detectives. Reports of unidentified flying objects began to make their way to the IFSB by the boatload, with people eager to seek membership in the group. Bender even took the time to answer the letters that personally reached him night in and night out. On the evening of July 30th, 1952, just a few months after the IFSB was formed, an anonymous telephone call came into the Bender household. Albert answered the call, but when he picked up, no one said a word on the other end. However, Bender's gut instinct told him that there was indeed someone at the other end of the line. Very suddenly, he became quite dizzy, and his head began throbbing with pain, thus prompting him to lay down in bed. Just a few days later, Mr. Bender took a walk to the local movie theater to watch a newly released science fiction flick. When the film concluded, he began his walk home, but became suspicious that someone was following him. Albert made it back to his house without incident and quietly made his way up to the attic, so as not to disturb his stepfather. As he approached the door, a now extremely nervous Bender noticed an eerie glow emerging from beneath the doorframe. He quickly swung the door open and immediately noticed the unmistakable and powerful scent of burning sulfur and a bright, shimmering object hovering in the room. Bender's eyes began to feel oddly irritated, and as he turned on the light, the enigmatic object disappeared without a trace. Afterward, he took notice of the fact that some of his IFSB files had been moved around, but by who or what, he was uncertain. This is a good time to mention the fact that various forms of paranormal phenomena had plagued the Bender family for years prior to Albert's experiences. As a child, one of his cousins had a terrifying night visitation from a woman in black. Another relative from northern Pennsylvania passed away from a brain hemorrhage that certain members of the family believed was directly caused by a supernatural entity that haunted a cemetery nearby. The Bender family was all too familiar with some of the darker facets of the phenomenon. On a dark night in November 1952, Bender was enjoying an evening watching yet another new sci-fi release at the theater when he was overcome by a sudden and heavy feeling of dread and anxiety. That and the feeling of being watched from the darkness that surrounded him. As Bender's negative sensations peaked, his attention was suddenly drawn to a human-like form that had shockingly materialized in a
nearby scene. IFSB. And the editor of a small publication called Space...
And according to what Dahl said, some of this material hit his son, injuring his son's arm, and supposedly killed his dog. And then after the object lost its material, it regained its stability, and all of these objects then departed. So Dahl spoke to his supervisor, Fred Chrisman. Here's where the Men in Black scenario comes in with Harold Dahl. The next day, what it comes down to is there was a diner in that area where he's having breakfast the next day, and he has a conversation with this mysterious man he's never met before. Dahl initially expected this man was a lumber dealer, and he was expecting just to do a standard business arrangement with this guy. He dealt with strangers all the time who were interested in lumber. It turns out this man was nothing of the sort. This man then relates every single thing that had happened to Dahl the previous day. And he knew all about it to Dahl's shock. I mean, that would be a shocking thing for anyone to experience. And this mysterious man essentially said, look, you're just going to leave this alone. and you're not going to pursue this in any way whatsoever if you know what's good for you. And so that's an intimidating experience for so many reasons. You can imagine poor Harold Dahl thinking, this is 1947. You're in America in 1947. You're not under the assumption that you're living in a surveillance state. And so you can imagine the shock he had to have felt thinking, wait, what? How do you know about anything that happened to me yesterday? So there's that level. And then there's the implied threat from this man, which just added to it. Dahl did not have in his possession the slag at the time. There was an enormous amount of this stuff. So, like, we're talking much more than any one person could carry around. The bulk of this ended up in the possession of Fred Crisman, Dahl's boss. And eventually, the United States Air Force sends two men to investigate and retrieve whatever this material is. And they actually do get to do this, and they load all of this slag material onto an Air Force transport. Actually, this is Army Air Corps at the time. This is just before the Air Force has become an independent, unified entity, separate from the Army. So they come up from McCord Airfield in California to acquire this material, and they do. And on their way back from Maury Island, their plane catches fire and goes down, and they die. That's what happened. And after that, I don't know what happened to the slag material or whatever this was, but their plane crashed.
What is the true mission of the Men in Black? Is it the suppression of information regarding UFOs and extraterrestrials? Or is it to aid them and further their agenda?
Well, let me tell you, Jim, I've had visits from government agents, various alphabet-type organizations connected to the work that I do here. And they are, even though they seem easygoing and very nice guys, there is no question about it, Jim. I'm just talking about normal government agents here. In black suits, you know they're carrying, they've got a sort of a serious, we're here, and you don't want to mess with this kind of attitude about them. And even though they're very nice and very calm, there's no question about the fact that there is an aura of intimidation that you could cut with a knife.
So relating to the story of a man named Albert Bender, who also had a very interesting experience, which Bender was one of the earliest organizers of kind of civilian UFO groups, the International Flying Saucer Bureau. It was a publication that was quite successful by 1952 standards. You know, printing out the publication, mailing it out, getting subscriptions that way. It's not easy. It wasn't easy to do back then.
Albert K. Bender founded the International Flying Saucer Bureau in 1952 during the big UFO flap.
That's by far the biggest year they had. And you could say the Project Blue Book was, you could say, the first ATIP, you know, the Advanced Aerial Threat Identification Program that we've learned about since then. But in Blue Book, they had over 1,500 UFO reports for that year, which this is all pre-internet. To get that many reports that people send in, that's a lot.
And sure,
a lot of those were
there. Here comes two gentlemen through the front door, looking exactly how he described. Then the next day, I was talking with my tour guest, and one of them asked to talk to me. She came in my office, the same as my bellman, and she said, I heard that you heard that there were some men looking for you. And she said, they asked a few questions about you, and they said strange things that I didn't understand. And they were talking about governments and conspiracies, and none of it made any sense to me. But she goes, they were very, very scary. She said they had no eyebrows, no eyelashes, nothing. Their hair looked like they had a wig on, like it was attached to their hat, like it wasn't even real. And she said, and the scariest thing, their eyes were so big and so blue that they almost hypnotized me a little bit. And she goes, and you're going to think I'm crazy when I tell you this, but I swear they knew what I was thinking.
Very intense military encounters, very well documented. This is the year that, for two weekends in a row, flying saucers were seen over the Capitol in Washington, D.C. that summer. It was the summer in which the United States Air Force held an enormous press conference all about this. It was a year in which, if you were to go into Wright-Patterson Air Force Base's Project Blue Book office, according to Edward Ruppelt, who was running it back then, he said, if you were to come in here, you would have thought there was an invasion underway. It was that intense. There were a lot of people in the military who actually believed that the secret was going to come out that year. That's how big it was. So in the midst of all that, you have a young guy like Bender who is investigating this on his own, and he's getting contributions from other writers, and he's got a decent publication going. It's quite successful.
Now, this blew up and went international immediately. Within that first year, he already had offices in the UK and also Australia. And you have to realize, this is long before the internet, cell phones, and our current technology. He was doing all this through snail mail and, if he could afford it, long-distance telephone calls back when you had to pay long-distance charges. So, on a very limited budget, he was able to make this very large organization that was compiling all of this information on UFO activity at the time, and also producing a newsletter that would get mailed out as well.
And then, seemingly out of the blue, in March 1953, he just shuts the whole thing down and just runs away. And no one hears from Albert Bender. He just makes his quick announcement, I'm done, we're not doing this anymore, see ya.
Nobody really knew what truly happened. Gray Barker, a writer and publisher at that time, also involved in the UFO community, tried to get some details out of him and published a few scant details during the mid-1950s, but never really got a clear answer. But then in the early 1960s, a little over 10 years later, Gray Barker published a book by Albert K. Bender called Flying Saucers and the Three Men, where Albert K. Bender told his story about what had really happened to him.
And 9 years after that, in 1962, Bender wrote a book called Flying Saucers and the Three Men, and he gives the story about why this all happened. Why did he shut it down in 1953? And here's where we get into a definite paranormal description of the men in black.
Now, what Bender claimed is that he started being visited by three strange men. He would go into his bedroom at night, and all of a sudden, three shadowy figures would materialize through the walls. Now, these figures were very dark in nature. They were wearing hats, almost like a fedora style, and they had glowing eyes. Now, when I first heard this story, coming from a paranormal background like I do, I immediately thought of shadow people, the hat wearing shadow entities that many people talk about observing and having interactions with. Now, Albert K. Bender believed that these were actually extraterrestrials, that they had come to warn him off of all the work that he was doing, and these guys are the reason why he disbanded the International Flying Saucer Bureau. Now, other people hear this story, and they believe this is a Men in Black story, that it was the Men in Black that had arrived and warned him off of all of his flying saucer research. Now, with Bender, what he believed that these entities were, that they were ETs, they were extraterrestrials from some other world that had come to our planet to harvest resources down in Antarctica, where they were harvesting these resources out of the water. They were here on a 15-year mission to do so, and Albert Bender could not say anything about the true nature of what he had observed, who he was interacting with, and why he had disbanded the International Flying Saucer Bureau until these ETs had left Earth, which is why, several years later in the 1960s, he came forth with the story and published the book through Gray Barker.
He noted that they had red eyes. So anytime you're gonna see a being that can mysteriously enter your room and they've got red eyes, I think the implication is gonna be that these aren't quite from our neighborhood. They're from somewhere else. So Bender, you know, it's tough enough for people to accept this ordinary paranormal element of the story, and that's difficult enough. Then he added that they gave him, well, they gave the reason why he couldn't investigate this, and they according to Bender, they said, well, we're mining under in Antarctica. And this is very important, and we don't want you to disturb this and cause us any trouble. And they gave him, according to Bender, they gave him a medallion and stated, when this medallion disappears, that will mean that we're gone. And then you can talk about us. You cannot talk about us until then. And according to that reasoning, the medallion disappeared, I guess, in the early 1960s, prompting Bender to write his book, which was published in 1962. And, you know, I mean, it's not difficult to understand why people would have a very hard time to believe that. Where's the evidence? Oh, well, the evidence disappeared. No medallion. Antarctica, like, especially in the 1950s, you know, there would be no reason anyone would possibly think that there was work going on in Antarctica, the most remote, desolate part of the planet. Pretty fantastic. Nowadays, there's all kinds of talks and rumors about Antarctica in the UFO field. It never stops.
Fully illuminated round object was hovering silently over the missile silo and shining a light down onto it.
And then from this dead stop, it shoots off to the east. Just like now you see it, now you don't.
This planet is being visited by beings from another world.
The unmistakable shape of a sharply dressed man in a brim hat was now only feet from Mr. Bender, with eyes that, bizarrely, glowed like flashlight bulbs. To make matters worse, another dizzy spell coupled with nausea struck him upon the arrival of the dark phantasm, and once more he fell into a state of unconsciousness. Upon waking, he did his best to return his attention to the film he was viewing, which, if I may inject my own personal anecdote into this story, his actions were the complete opposite of what I, and likely most others, would have done faced with a dark specter of unknown origin. Minutes later, the now unmistakable feeling of being watched returned. As Albert Bender turned around slowly, he saw it once again, the same impeccably dressed phantom staring at him coldly and harshly. Without hesitation, Bender quickly retreated to the safety and familiarity of his attic. In the following months, Bender experienced bouts of dizziness and encountered entities wearing dark suits that haunted him both day and night. Additionally, the attic was plagued by sudden and alarming outbursts of poltergeist activity, as well as the persistent presence of brimstone-like odors that lingered for days. Furthermore, he developed severe and persistent headaches resembling migraines.
Late in the summer of 1953, Bender made a number of discoveries which led him to believe that he had finally found the truth of the UFO cover-up. He had planned to reveal his findings in a tell-all October issue of Space Review that year in 1953. But before the issue was published and sent out to its members, Bender was visited by three men dressed in black, who had already somehow managed to read the unpublished report he had been working on and confirmed his findings, which shocked and terrified Bender to the bone. The silencers, as Bender referred to them, scared him to the point where he did not want to publish the October 1953 issue of Space Review. Bender then suspended publishing on his
book. One more thing before she left, she said, these men, they didn't blink. Not once did I see them blink.
You have told them you had already given it
to the vortex for testing.
Saying before she got, she said, these men, they didn't blink, but I swear they knew what I was thinking. And she started to cry, and she said one more thing before she left. She said, these men, they didn't blink. Not once did I see them blink. Not once did I see them blink. These men, they didn't blink. Didn't blink. Not once did I see them blink. For their hat, like it wasn't even real. And she said, nothing. There are conspiracies and none of
In the midst of this physical and psychological torment, three darkly clad men appeared and subjected Bender to the worst of his various visitations in 1953.
Location entirely and dissolved the International Flying Saucer Bureau soon thereafter. Shortly after we closed down the space review in the IFSB, he gave an interview to a local newspaper in which he stated that he had been visited by three men wearing dark suits and that they had ordered him to stop publishing materials about flying saucers. Bender said that he had been scared to death and couldn't eat or sleep for a couple of days. In 1963, Bender went into further and extended detail about his encounter in a book entitled Flying Saucers and the Three Black Men. It was a strange and unreadable book that had revealed very little about his alleged run-in with the Men in Black and omitted many details, according to those who have seen the book. Despite founding the International Flying Saucer Bureau, the first major civilian UFO organization in the world, in 1952, and having tremendous success at it, the IFSB was permanently shut down, and after 1963, Bender was virtually never heard.
According to a widely circulated account within the UFO research community, the enigmatic trio revealed to Bender the ominous truth about the presence of UFOs on our planet. They warned him with stern whispers to keep the knowledge to himself, unless he wished to incur their immediate and deadly wrath. Bender, who was petrified by the entire encounter, made the decision to leave the flying saucer scene for good. He closed the doors on the International Flying Saucer Bureau in October 1953, which shocked his followers as he announced his departure.